From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
President El-Sisi has been somebody that's been very close to me from the first time I met him.
Calming nerves in the Middle East, working back channels on Chinese relations, weighing in on infrastructure plans, and more. All that is on the desk of 36-year-old Jared Kushner.
The gagging, the gasping, the frantic efforts to save lives. These images from Idlib, Syria, outraged world leaders on Tuesday.
But let me leak the name of Mike Flynn.
I leaked nothing to nobody.
The idea that a Supreme Court justice appointed for life to the nation's highest court ought to be approved by more than a razor-thin majority. It ought to be an overwhelming bipartisan consensus. And so sometime later this week, the Republican leadership will have to decide whether it is going to embark on this profoundly historic, destructive step.
Yes, the nuclear option Richard Blumenthal is talking about there. A few of the voices from the news this week. You can join the conversation about what's been going on around the world, especially right here in Connecticut, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/thewheelhouse. And you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining me, as he always does on Wednesdays, is Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Did you just unmask me?
There will be more unmasking throughout the day. Let me unmask Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror. Howdy, Paz.
Good morning.
And Suzanne Bates is here. She's Policy Director at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Hello, Suzanne.
Good morning.
So let's start at the state level and talk about what's going on at the state in the state capital, around the state budget. There's a bunch of questions, obviously, around things that aren't budget-related, Paz, but more than anything else, we're trying to fix big budget problems. What's exactly happening right now at the Capitol today around the budget?
Today, nothing. The Finance and Appropriations Committees, their deadline is the end of the month, and they're moving forward. But, you know, the big question is, what will be the basic dynamics of doing a budget? And what I mean is, will the Democrats have to pass the budget as they have since Dan Malloy was first elected, only with Democratic votes? And if that's the case, which most people expect will be the case, it's going to be a very difficult thing. They have no votes to spare in the Senate. They have four votes to spare in the House. And the question for the Republicans, will they put forward a well-vetted budget alternative and try to coax four people over? And if they don't, you know, they're going to be answering questions for the next year and a half. If not, then why not?
When we talk about a budget, it starts, Colin, traditionally with a proposal that comes out from the governor, in this case, Governor Dan Malloy. Are there any other budget plans out there that we know of?
Well, that was my question to the people who spent a lot more time thinking about all this. Paz just answered half of it. I mean, sometimes you sort of know what what the governor's majority party also thinks. They usually, particularly in the case of this governor and this majority party, think something a little bit different from one another. And I guess I'm wondering, Paz, I mean, is there a sense that the Democrats want to do Y instead of Malloy's X? I mean, are there areas where you can see the difference between the – I mean, I understand there's not an alternative budget out, but can you see where the daylight is between the two?
You can quickly see the things that are non-starters or the things that make people absolutely crazy. And topping that list is the governor's proposal to shift some of the cost of teacher pensions onto the cities and towns. And the big problem with that is it's not just an expense he's shifting. It's a growing liability. So the towns aren't exactly inviting the governor to cut their education grant. But that would be preferable because that would be a dollar amount that is not going to grow. The teacher pension fund, making the towns pick up a share of that, it's basically handing them a share of a debt, of a liability that is projected to really go crazy in the next few years.
Suzanne, I'm guessing that shifting things around does not necessarily please you or the Yankee Institute.
Well, it's funny because I think I don't like the way our state does it in that we separate compensation out into little buckets, right? We've got the salaries over here, the pensions over here. You know, I mean, I don't think it makes for good budgeting. However, you know, like Mark said, to underpay your pensions for years and then say to the towns, oh, never mind, we're going to let you take this over now, I think is foolish. So I think this is just, again, pension reform. We need to have it because, and not just in the state employee system, the teacher system as well. We put $2 billion into the system in 2008, and since then, it's just gotten worse, not better. So it's all of these things are ticking time bombs in our budget, and we have to take care of them.
I guess my question also, I mean, to both of you, I have more questions than I have either answers or observations. Although, I mean, one of my observations is to what you're saying right now is that most of the fixes that have to do with benefits, I mean, and don't involve just the funding of benefits, are fixes that will probably wind you up in court. And so that's kind of hard for budget making if you think you're going to get sued over one of the reforms that you put in, which is not a reason not to do the reforms. I'm just sort of saying. But my questions are, and Suzanne, I think as we were kind of emailing around, I think you were suggesting this, there appears to be in the wind a bunch of different ideas about how to make this budget work, either on the revenue end or someplace else. What are you hearing in that regard?
I mean, I'm definitely hearing the Republicans are working to get a budget out. So, it's kind of funny to me because last year they put a budget out and everyone criticized them for calling for union concessions. And then this year, that's Malloy's whole budget is kind of based around these union concessions that we're all wondering how he's going to get. But I'm hearing, I mean, there's a lot of discord, I think, even amongst the Democrats. There's a lot of discord. You've got some moderates who really do not want to raise taxes again. They have to go home to their constituents and answer for that every time they do it. And 2015 was a disaster.
Well, are we going to see higher taxes, sales taxes, other types of taxes?
It's hard to see how you can balance this budget without new revenue. And there are Republicans for the moment who privately will concede that. But, I will be surprised if the Republicans put forward a budget that's a serious effort to lure over enough Democrats to pass it and own it, because everything this year is about 2018. This state, when it comes to state offices, is really balancing on a knife edge as far as which party will control all the levers of state government going forward after 2018. And understandably so, that affects people's behavior. People cannot take their eyes off of 2018 as they try to fix an immediate problem to get through this budget year without worsening the long-term problem. It really is. I mean, I hate to be so pessimistic on the opening week of baseball season, which is the time for optimism, unless the Pittsburgh Pirates just lost to the Red Sox. But anyway, it really is difficult. If you want to get a good, easy sense of this, my colleague Keith Faniff did a Q&A with Nick Perner, the economist. And Nick really had a nice way of synthesizing it. He was talking about Suzanne's big issue, the unfunded liabilities on pensions. And he said, deficits are not just corrosive to the confidence in the business climate, but eliminating them through taxes and spending cuts is a drag on the economy. So it comes down to how do you follow short-term pain with long-term gain? So far, the state has been very inept at doing that.
And he goes on to talk about needing to roll back existing benefits. We've talked in the past, Suzanne, about the state of Rhode Island rolling back cost of living allowances to state retirement beneficiaries. But it's not as easy as all of that. Nick is essentially saying we're in a state of emergency. There's a little bit of discontinuity there when Paz says everyone's focused on 2018. And then we have a leading economist in the state saying we're in a state of emergency right now.
Right. I think people are focused on 2018, but I really see a lot of focus on this year and the budget. I think people are worried we're going to be here till August trying to figure this out. I mean, look around, there are other states, Pennsylvania and Illinois, who, they'll go a year or more in Illinois' case without a budget. It's that ugly here this year, and it's that ugly 2 years from now and 4 years from now. So how do we fix it so that we could get out of this cycle? And I think to Colin's point about courts, I don't think
that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah, I mean, look, I do think you might end up in court if you try to change cost of living adjustments. Yeah. But how about we start out by changing just for new hires? Mm-hmm. You don't end up in court there.
Right.
So for teachers and state employees, how about we just start out with that? Stop the bleeding. and change things for new hires. I mean, that's step one. We can't even get there.
Right. There's sort of a pull up the ladder problem with doing it only to new hires. But I take your point. And when I said end up in court, I was thinking specifically of Nick's quote about that. That's the kind of thing in Rhode Island. They find out you end up in court. I will say this, as on a political point, what's been interesting is the degree to which really, because there aren't counter proposals right now, there's just whisperings in the wind and there's not a Republican alternative budget and a little hard to see exactly what the Democrats want to do different from Malloy. Malloy's kind of, you know, I mean, in the words of Nancy Wyman, dance the man. You know, Malloy kind of has dominated this process so far. And when, you know, I mean, all of us who cover politics, we get comments on social media or wherever saying, you know, very anti-Malloy comments. Lately, I've been saying he's the only person who has identified priorities right now and put something down on paper. It's hard to get mad at him at the moment. And maybe he's sort of using the fact that his, you know, approval rating is already pretty low. He can't get that much worse. So he's willing maybe to take some of the bad medicine.
And we'll hear from the governor again. But the question, it will be timed. The legislature, again, I keep using, you know, Elizabeth Kubler Ross, the stages of grief. The legislature is sort of processing this. You know, there's the anger, denial, all this stuff. And they need to run a few scenarios. Will we see a budget put up that's voted down this year just so people can see, folks, the votes for your idea aren't there? Generally speaking, leaders don't like to do that. They don't like their members to be recorded voting for an ugly budget if it's not going to pass. And all these budgets are going to be ugly. Perhaps the only good part of people focused on 2018 is the Republicans, the ones who understand budgeting and the problems they face, some of them are starting to think, we could be in charge after 2018. So it does behoove us to reduce this problem now, or we will have the Pyrrhic victory of all victories in 2018 if they win control of a state that is the speed at which it's spiraling around the drain is picking up.
I will just say I didn't know that there was a stage after denial. I thought it just held right at denial the entire time. The only person in America who likes to talk about the state spending cap is here with us, so I figured that I'd turn to her, Suzanne Bates. You know, it's been a subject of discussion at the state capitol. What do we make of a spending cap that isn't actually a cap on anything, and how might we repair, fix, or actually utilize this strategy moving forward of some sort of a cap on state spending?
So the spending cap was supposed to limit spending to what the people could afford. So it was supposed to grow at the same rate. The government spending was supposed to grow at the same rate as your income. But 25 years ago, when they passed the constitutional amendment, the legislature has never fully enacted it because there are things they're supposed to do. And I mean, it's when I think about it, it does make me upset. 25 years of kind of ignoring this spending cap because there are people who just don't want a spending cap. But it's in the Constitution. You can't ignore it.
If it wasn't in the Constitution, would it be a reasonable thing to do? Does it actually make sense to have an artificial spending cap that doesn't allow you to react to the realities of that particular budget cycle?
I would say it's yes, it absolutely makes sense. And I think it's not an artificial. I mean, what it does is it says if there's an extraordinary circumstance and you need extraordinary votes to react to that circumstance.
Like a state of emergency?
Right. Well, so then you need 3/5 to vote over the cap, right? I mean, that makes sense to me because otherwise you end up with the government that we have now that's growing so quickly that, you know, taxpayers can't keep up.
Well, it's not growing quickly right now. I mean, the check on spending right now is the fact we don't have any money.
It's growing quickly compared to how our revenues are growing. It's growing faster than our
revenues.
In
part because of the pension liabilities,
yes.
The debt we ran up 20, 30 years ago that we have to pay off. It's not the general government that's growing right now.
I mean, yeah. I think there's this misunderstanding about the pensions. So we didn't start paying till 1970s on our pensions. No states started paying till 1970s on our pensions. The problem we've had over and over and over again is that we kept not paying for them through the 80s and the 90s and early 2000s. And then, you know, we also overinflated our expectations. We also had very expensive pensions. We have the highest average pension in the nation. So there was kind of this reluctance to pay the full price of it, understandably. So there were sort of these deals between the unions and the administrations not to pay into those pension systems. So it's really more than just this 30-year-old problem. It was an ongoing issue.
The spending cap is sort of the ultimate millennial. It's 25 years old and it's never worked. It's been living in the basement of a
series.
Here
come the calls.
It's been okay. That's a cliche about millennials.
We've been trying to engage our millennial fan base here. I'm glad now we're going to get some calls.
Thank you for that. That was a little joke about millennials. I don't really mean that. But
is your son listening right now?
Yeah. Well. So anyway, yeah. So it's been sitting in the OPM director's basement playing video games, and I think that's something that's been in the Constitution for 25 years and has. And I think Suzanne would agree with me, never had an effect. I mean, basically, there's been a series of ways of getting around it, of excluding certain things from spending and stuff like that. And the essential terms of the amendment, as Suzanne was alluding to, have never been defined. I question whether at age 25 you can jumpstart this thing. In some ways, I think, you know, you're better off. I mean, it's hard to point to a process that's working better because we know how they actually do it, and that's not good either. But I'm not sure getting the spending cap to work is a reasonable thing to try to do. And the reality is budget making is kind of, in a very vague way, mapped on to what the spending cap is. Basically, in budget making, what you're essentially saying is how much can people stand to pay for state government before they come to the state capitol with pitchforks?
Well, I feel like we've reached that tipping point. How much are people willing to pay? I mean, we're losing population. We've got
so
all
there's
the
your
other
spending
problems.
Cap. There's your spending cap.
Well,
right
so,
there.
But yeah. this, but yet
it's a market-driven spending
themselves.
Cap. You should like this.
Yes, I do like this.
If you could go good back point, in time, the spending the cap would be really important to have work. But today, I mean, the budget process right now is the legislature is on this long ride in a car that may break down, over bridges that may fall, and the spending cap is worrying about, well, when we finally get there, will there be enough food? Which is an important question, but right now it's how do we do the budget? The spending cap, if we could go back to the mid-90s and the 2000s, all the bad deals that Democratic legislative leaders and Republican governors cut, it would make a difference.
So it has actually made a difference. And so OPM, I was on the spending cap commission.
Oh, she just pivoted.
I know. I was on the spending cap commission, and they gave us numbers, and we saw them, and it did make a difference. Did it make as big a difference as I would have liked? No, but it did make a difference. The other thing is it's in our state's constitution. You can only ignore it for so long. It's there. So unless you all want to jumpstart a repeal this, provision of the constitution, I think it's still really popular among people. And when you talk to them about it, I mean, I think the general public gets really frustrated when they hear that there's something in our Constitution that lawmakers are essentially just ignoring.
The idea of it perhaps is popular. It can't actually the reality of it can't be popular in that it has never fully worked. So I take your point. I just want to get to a quick phone call here. Donna in Southbury. Donna, are you calling because of Colin's millennial joke?
No, I wish. Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I think the thing that I'm calling in regards to the teachers' retirement board pension, I think the thing that is not being discussed and what people don't understand is that we don't pay into the Medicare system. Now, we can go down another path and talk about how that's not going to be funded and whatever, but we as teachers don't have the luxury of saying, okay, well, if they don't pay my full pension that I put in good faith, then at least I'm going to have my Medicare as my supplement. We don't have that either, unless many
you mean
of us
Social Security, don't you?
No, we don't pay into Social Security. We have to. So when I put in zero, I put in zero. I have to show what I pay into my pension, but I don't pay in anything to Medicare. So my Social Security, unless I have a part-time job, that's when I would pay into it.
A quick thought, Suzanne?
Well, and that's why I think you can't change existing benefits for teachers, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about changing benefits for teachers who are already vested or retired. I'm talking about why don't we put new hires on Social Security? Why not ask the towns to pick up that cost, start there, and then build a slightly smaller pension system on top of that for new hires? why don't we make some of these kind of incremental changes? But for new hires, again, I understand the problem with Social Security for existing teachers, but that's a choice the state makes. And you know, that's, we don't have to make that choice. We could put new teachers onto Social Security.
I would just say, first of all, well, I agree with Suzanne, and I hear you, and I feel your pain. I will say to the rest of the nation, the kind of betrayal that the caller is describing is, of course, the dream that lives in the heart of Paul Ryan. What Paul Ryan would like to do to everybody else who's not a teacher is take a system that they have paid into and rip it to shreds. So just, you know, I have a plan to kidnap him and give him a pink belly. I won't ask any public school teachers to help me.
Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Suzanne Bates is here from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Mark Pazniokas, the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror at ctmirror.org. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about some other issues that are being talked about at the state level, including pay equity and family leave. Also be turning to some cuts to the state university system. A lot more to talk about here in the Wheelhouse on WNPR. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, and our own Colin McEnroe. Colin, what's on your show today?
Well, tonight I'm doing an event at Watkinson that'll be a future show, so we're rerunning. You may wish sometimes that you could still live pretty much where you live, but in a different reality. And so we did a show a while back about the concept of the multiverse within physics. So it would be possible for you, for Suzanne, to live, you know, in a place that's closely resembled her own reality, but there was a spending cap that worked.
So that's...
We don't mention that specifically in the show.
That's on today's show. What's your thing at Watkinson tonight?
We're talking about language, not only the way that language changes just in conventional discourse, but also ways in which political language has become increasingly loaded. So words like elites get thrown around without necessarily having any clear meaning.
Okay, so that's happening tonight with Colin McEnroe at Watkinson.
But don't show
School.
Up. We're sold, we're
They're
sold out.
They're sold out, already sold out. A good show coming up this afternoon. As we continue our little promo fest here, I will say that Suzanne is appearing on CPTV on a program tomorrow night, Thursday, April 6th. It's called Life Lessons, Understanding Paid Family Leave, and it's going to be hosted by Diane Smith. I figured I'd use this as an opportunity both to promote this program from our sister station, CPTV, and also ask you about what you're going to be talking about proposals for paid family leave in the state.
Can I make one other point?
Yeah.
Suzanne also is going to be in a public television dramatic program coming up called Bounton Abbey, set in Danbury.
Not quite sure where to go with that. So
we're working on the pilot right now. It's actually going to be fantastic. It has some cast members from The Walking Dead.
You can always ignore
a few early 2000s rap artists. It's going to be fantastic.
Sure,
actually,
need,
bunch of Ecuadorians,
you know.
Too.
Anyway. Paid family leave, Suzanne. This is something that's being talked about at the state capitol. You're discussing with Diane Smith tomorrow at CPTV. What's your take on the proposals that are out there?
I think this is the wrong time to try to put a paid family leave program into Connecticut. I mean, the cost would be enormous. And at a time when we're losing jobs and struggling just to maintain the government we have, I just think this is the wrong time. I'd also, if we're going to have a paid family leave program, I'd rather see it at the federal level than at the state level. I think there are some good reasons, and in fact, I've heard some strong conservatives advocate for a paid family leave program at the federal level. I could see myself getting behind that. I'm still grappling with it, but I can't imagine how we can do it right now.
And again, the proposal that passed out of the Labor and Public Employees Committee last week would allow employees to earn up to 12 weeks of paid family and medical leave. So really quickly, why at the federal level a proposal like that, not at the state level?
Because I think it works with a bigger population. It's an insurance program, essentially, right? So I think it works. And the proposal that passed out at the state level is it affects businesses as few as two employees. It's just a very large, cumbersome program compared to what other states have done. And compared to what I think we would see at the federal level, it's really unworkable, actually, I think, financially in its current form.
And we should make clear it's employee funded. I mean, you alluded to it. It is an insurance program. It's employee funded. But, yeah, it is an added burden to the state to administer it. To the your point
well,
about
and it, because it's employee funded, it's a new payroll tax.
Right.
So we're essentially it's essentially a tax increase too. So,
But I thought there was an opt out. I believe there's an opt out.
So
it is you're buying insurance. You are contributing it, and it's a question of how many years would it take to fill. No.
I don't know. I don't know how it works with an opt out. But anyway,
we'll have to take a closer look at the bill.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's
passed out of committee. Is this something that we've talked about various things that have to do with the budget, but don't have to necessarily do with the budget that people might be acting on?
And the Malloy administration has been kind of wary about it because it is something the Department of Labor would have to administer. It does require staff, and so they've been trying to construct the bill in a way that's revenue neutral, and they've even talked about having it roll out, take quite a number of years, that the money would have to flow into this fund before anybody would get a benefit. So there are a lot of questions about this. And yeah, there's a lot of reluctance in this budget year to jump in. But it's another example of drawing a contrast with the Trump administration. And again, to return to my theme that everything's about 2018, the Democrats love that contrast, and we're going to see that today on a pay equity debate that's probably going to go forward in the House. That plays off of something the Trump administration did recently, rolling back an executive order that requires certain pay equity rules for federal contractors.
Well, look, I know you cover politics at the Capitol. It might be seen by some as a bit cynical to look at paid family leave and pay equity as purely political calculations, taking a look at 2018.
And I'm not suggesting it's purely political, but that's certainly an element. It's a strong contrast. And, you know, to Suzanne's point about things that would work better as federal policy, that's always an issue in Connecticut. To what extent does either by virtue of actual cost or perception, does it put Connecticut at a competitive disadvantage? But the reason we see these things constantly debated here is they can't get a hearing in Congress. So people like the Working Families Party will push a $15 an hour minimum wage in California, in New York, in Connecticut, in the hopes of forcing the federal government to eventually look at a higher minimum wage or look at policies like paid family leave.
At the pay equity level, there is, of course, a debate going on. At the federal level as well, Rosa DeLauro is a big player in it. You sort of need two things, one of which Connecticut has. I hope I'm right about this. Well, but, you know, you do need two things. First of all, you need to know what everybody's getting paid. So Connecticut kind of took care of that last year. Although, bear in mind, I sound like a broken record here, but so many of these things, they sound like great solutions. And they are great solutions. But – she's shaking her head. They're not great solutions. But they get resolved in the courts, right? I mean, there isn't somebody running around, you know, with a flashlight and a baton making sure this stuff works out. If it doesn't work out, somebody has to bring a legal action. So, but I will say this. This pay equity is a bedrock issue. It's a bedrock issue which has to be resolved for our society to move forward. I mean, we just can't go on like this anymore with women making such a much low. I mean, the reason there's this thing called the Pay Equity Day, which I think was yesterday. Monday, is that's the day when, on average, on balance, women's salaries catch up with the men's salaries from the year before. It's an intolerable situation. Some of it will get fixed by the market. Women are more hireable, more employable, better educated. Women are moving way ahead of men among the cohorts coming into the workplace right now. But that doesn't change things for somebody who's a 58-year-old woman who's not getting paid for the same work she does that a man's getting paid more for. And that has to be fixed. It's wrong.
Yes, that is wrong. I still remember as a young, so I was a reporter, was working for the Associated Press, and I still remember saying to him, well, women don't get paid as much as men. And he kind of sat me down and said, well, here's the thing. It's that number, that 78 cents, whatever it is now, is not apples to apples. And I felt so angry. I felt like I had been lied to. I'd been fed all of this you are disadvantaged as a woman, you don't get paid as much. But it's not about the same work. That number is this terrible aggregate number that is so misleading. And
explain why it's misleading?
Because it's not comparing apples to apples. It's comparing all women who work compared to all men who work. And so there are choices involved in that number. And when you iron out some of the choices, it's actually most women are getting paid the same as men for the same work at this point. And thankfully, if they're not, we have recourse for that now. There are already many laws in the books. I feel like these pay equity laws are trying to fix a problem that we already have some legal fixes for, and you're never going to get at the full extent of it because it's about choice, right? I mean, I'm expecting my fifth child. I made choices along the way. I've been in and out of the workforce. I've worked freelance because I wanted to be home more with my kids, and that was a choice our family made. But, you know, because of that, I get paid less than my husband, and that's okay to me, you know, but I think that
it's okay to you. I would imagine that there are several women probably rushing to call the program right now who are saying that's not a choice I made and that's not a choice that I want to have imposed on me. It's harder for me to make the same money that somebody else might make in the same job. And it's factually true.
That's factually not true. It's factually not true. When you look at it, when you look at people who are in the workforce and you compare apples to apples, right? Same job, same education, same level of experience, same ability to work long hours. They're actually almost even. I mean, the pay it takes out all of that
There's mixed data on that, and there's some subtleties. Suzanne is absolutely right when you look at the 78 cents or the 83 cents figure. It smooths over, you know, whether their choices or whether their role society imposes on women. But yes, a lot of women, the factor is they depart from the workforce, they interrupt careers, that affects their earning power, and that's a whole nother longer discussion about whether to what extent it's voluntary or forced or a mix. But there are cases of direct comparisons where the numbers don't quite add up. And then there's also the issue of as certain jobs became taken over by women, they tended to lose some of their earning power. And that is true of secretary. There was a time when, you know, executive secretaries were men and they were paid much higher. As jobs were taken over by women, there is historical evidence that they tended to lose some of their ability to command higher salaries. So, you know, I think Suzanne's right to a degree, but I think it's far more complicated, and there still is plenty of evidence of gender inequity in pay.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, in executive boardrooms, certainly, and there are still many jobs in America that are overrepresented by a female workforce in which the salaries tend to be lower than those of men. But anyway, quickly, I know.
But that's choice too, right? I mean, women are more likely to choose social work, and men are more likely to choose engineering.
Don't we need teachers? Don't we need people to teach
absolutely
grade school kids?
But the market,
we don't need
right?
that, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And if the market is artificially tamped down, you're only going to make so much money to do something you love and want to do.
And I think your assumption that it's artificially tamped down is different than my assumption. I think it's supply and demand, right? Some of those workforces, you have more supply than you have in the engineering field, for example. They're constantly looking for more people, so they're having to pay a higher salary.
Right, and the only thing that really matters anyway, ultimately, is can a woman engineer doing the same job as a male engineer with roughly the same amount of experience and education make the
That's
same
right.
amount of money?
Yes.
It doesn't. The argument that we're having right now is not a particularly meaningful one, except in terms of whether or not these kinds of aggregate census-based statistics are meaningful. And I would agree, they're not all that meaningful. But I would also agree with Paz. You get down to the granular level, there are still differences. There are 15-cent wage gaps, you know, in terms of hourly wages and stuff like that, too. So.
And that's why we have these laws that you can sue if that's the case. And I'm fully in support of that. But I think what we're doing right now is we're just trying to pile on to this, trying to fix a problem that I don't think you're ever going to get that 82-cent number, whatever it is, up to that full dollar, again, because of these choices. And trying to artificially do that is just causing harm.
So good news for female lawyers. They can get in on all these lawsuits that are going to come forward. I want to talk about consolidations in the state university system. In an email sent this week, Mark Ojakian, the head of this CSCU system, which is very hard for me to remember all the letters in there, said a looming projected $35 million decrease in funding from the state has left, quote, a few areas to trim expenses, given 80% of our total spending is dedicated to personnel costs, 95% of our full-time staff is represented by bargaining units. He's talking about some cuts and some shifting around of things, Colin. What do we see here?
I think, although we have some lively disagreements here around the table today, I bet you all of us would agree that historically, for decades, this has been a very badly run, inefficiently managed, and luxuriously salaried area, I mean, in terms of the highest executive levels, of state government. And I probably do have more confidence in Mark Ohjakian and maybe Matt Flurry, who's now the head of the Board of Knights Templar or whatever they're called, to do more about this. But I do think there's two problems here, and we're only talking about one of them. I think OJ is going to be most able to look at some of these efficiencies, and I think all of them are worth considering. I mean, I think you can make a really good case for the fact that not every community college needs a president. You could probably have some kind of central office of the community college and then have a Starfleet officer, you know, ranking Starfleet officer at each community college, stuff like that. There's a and certainly in terms of purchasing, and I mean, there's a lot of centralization that can be done that probably will create efficiencies. And it ought to be done. But if we're going to just focus on closing that $35 million gap or whatever it is, we can't forget about what this system is for. It's for students. Usually when you start hearing about these kinds of efficiencies and budget savings and restructurings, you start hearing from all these kind of constituencies who feel their own turf is threatened or, you know, that they're going to get screwed in some way, but they're not the students. And first and foremost, this system has to operate so that a student can walk into it, get a clear picture of what he or she has to do to get to the next level. Those things that the student needs to do, the classes the student needs to take, have to be available in a fairly easy way. And the choke points that are stopping people from advancing, which are there, need to be loosened up and eliminated. You know, this is such an important part of our society. This is where upward mobility happens. The two-year college level and then the state four-year college level, this is one of the most gigantically important sectors of the kind of society I think we all want to have. But you have to put the student first. I hope OJ and Matt and people like that can get these efficiencies accomplished. But that's not the only job. The job's got to be the other half of the job, and it's a bigger half, is student focused.
And I'll just say quickly, Paz, is that the student focused in this system is all about in-state students, whereas University of Connecticut for a long time ago switched to being a place that welcomes in people from all over the world and all over the country. We're really talking about kids who grow up here in Connecticut and want to get a job here in Connecticut and are going through the system to do it.
So Ohjakian is trying to do what was anticipated in 2011 when the 12 community colleges were merged with the four state universities, basically everything but UConn, as well as an online college, Charter Oak. And for a variety of reasons, mainly because they've been through two presidents and two interim leaders before Ohjakian, really a political guy, was named president and brought some stability. Those things never happened. So to Colin's point, Ohjakian says that's exactly what he's trying to do. He's not just trying to get through a one-year deficit and deal with projected shortfalls in the future. He is trying to direct while cutting overall funds by shedding administrative levels and doing certain efficiencies, he's trying to bring direct services to students. At Gateway Community College, he told me the other day, there's something like one advisor for 2,000 students. And these are, you know, a lot of community college students, boy, they need an advisor more than a lot of folks.
A lot of things,
And the other thing is they need to be much, much quicker on letting students know what their financial aid is going to look like, because it's open admission. So what they really know is, okay, what's the real price? Don't tell me what the sticker price is, because these are kids in many cases where, you know, a few dollars here and there is going to make all the difference. So Ohjakian is really trying to do that. The challenge he will have is he's had some entrepreneurial presidents. The trick will be, as you wipe out that layer in some places, to what extent do you lose that oomph, that leadership? And that's always
fair question.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think of all of the administration, maybe the president's more important than a lot of the layers of administration that are there. But I think, I mean, to your point, the graduation rate among community college students is terrible. Mm-hmm. It's terrible.
And the retention
low rate
is dropping as well.
It's terrible. And because we're graduating fewer children out of our high schools, we're seeing lower enrollments because these colleges are full of state-owned students, state-grown, anyway, students. we're seeing the population shrink at the colleges too. So there are so many problems that they need to address.
Well, there's that demographic issue. The college age population is shrinking. Now, community college is a little bit different. When the economy tanks, community college enrollment tends to go up because people go for all kinds of reasons, mid-career retraining. It's a kind of a different
thing. It's not just
thing.
The traditional student. Yeah. We have to take a break here. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the national issues in front of us, including considering Super Jared, who's flying around the world solving our problems. We're talking with Mark Pazniokas of the Connecticut Mirror, Suzanne Bates of the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, and our own Colin McEnroe. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news with Colin McEnroe, Mark Pazniokas of the Connecticut Mirror, and Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Colin, you had a really fascinating conversation earlier this week with the author of a story about the new wave of Kennedys, and it got us thinking a little bit about people who may be running for governor here, including Ted Kennedy Jr.
Yeah, you know, and I like Ted Kennedy Jr. I think he's a really nice guy, and I think he actually also has a lot of really good ideas. I don't really think it's a good idea for him to run for governor. I think he needs probably more time in the saddle. This is going to be probably all gubernatorial campaigns are really grueling and horrible and awful, you know, and they suck the life right out of you. I think he's new enough to this that it doesn't really make sense for him to do this. I also don't necessarily know that his skill set right now matches up terribly well with what it takes to be governor. But yeah, I mean, he certainly is. I mean, if there's a Kennedy, that Kennedy will be mentioned for higher office. That's a rule of the universe.
Is he going to run, Paz? And who else is going to run, you think, in 2018? A couple of key names.
Ted Kennedy Jr. is definitely looking at it. I think if he had his druthers, he would coax George Jepson into running for governor, and Kennedy would run for attorney general.
That's not happening.
I don't believe that's happening. The question is Ted Kennedy ready for a statewide campaign in what's going to be, I think, a very ugly year? I think the type of campaign that will be run, given this environment nationally and here, it's going to be ugly. I think it's one of many factors that probably will end up dissuading Nancy Wyman, for example, from going forward, because that's not her style of campaigning. So you have kind of no obvious front runners, which tends to entice people to jump in or at least take a good look. The calendar says, you know, before public financing, people waited. You know, Governor Weicker didn't announce until the fall that he wasn't running. Jody Rell didn't announce until the fall. Governor O'Neill didn't announce until March of that election year that he wasn't running. We expect to hear from Dan Malloy before that.
It's really hard to raise that money. I mean, people underestimate how hard it is to raise the seed money that you need to qualify for the CEP.
And Dan Malloy understands that. It took him a year. He created his candidate committees 2 years out, and he knows better than anyone why people have to get in early.
I'm bothered by the aristocratic nature of the whole Kennedy clan, 2.0 coming through and kind of assuming that they can take these statewide offices and higher offices without as much work as everybody else. It's interesting to contrast that with what happened to Jeb Bush in the last presidential election. I mean, the Republicans kind of rejected that sort of aristocracy notion.
What a mistake that was.
Well, one could argue that maybe Jeb Bush and Donald Trump were the right answers. But anyway, that's a whole other issue. But I don't think Ted Kennedy Jr. should get to be governor just because he's a Kennedy. And but there is.
I don't think anybody would suggest that.
But it's funny how much
and
easier
it
will be for him to launch than most other senators that are in their second term.
Absolutely. But in the Globe piece that I think Colin talked about on the show, it was interesting that he declined to participate because he got badly burned in 2013,
yes,
because he followed the old family playbook that you find a friendly reporter at the New York Times and you have your coming out. And in this case, they called Mark Leibovich, who has this brutal, deliciously puckish sense of humor, and because he was considered safe. And it and Kennedy got humiliated in that piece, and I think he learned. I mean, he didn't need to be coming out to the New York Times. He needed to be coming out to the New Haven Register or perhaps the Branford Eagle if you're going to run for state senator.
If he decides to run, he could only hope that Russian hackers go in and destroy that from online sites anywhere.
Right.
That,
just quickly in his defense, too, he waited a long time to get into politics, much longer than people typically do, because, in fact, he knew what it was like to grow up as the kid of a politician. He didn't want his kids to have their childhoods pockmarked in that particular way.
Actually refreshing, somebody thinking about it before jumping right in. I'll just quickly say before we run out of time here, President Trump's approval rating hit a new low in a Quinnipiac poll this week. 35% of voters approve of the job Trump is doing as president, according to the poll. A majority of men, 51%, and white voters, 48%, groups that helped elect Trump disapprove. So what is he doing with all this? He's unleashing Colin's super Jared. This is his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who's flying around the world trying to solve problems. Frank Bruni in the Times today said, why don't we just stitch him a red cape, put him in spandex, affix a stylized S to his chest, and be done with it. Is Jared going to solve all the world's problems?
Well, I mean, I think the horrific subtext to here is that the Partnership for Public Service identified 553 key positions in the federal government that require Senate confirmation. 40 of those, and that's 553, 40 of them right now are kind of stuck in the Senate pipeline. 492 of them have no nominee. No one has been nominated. Calling this a slow transition is an understatement. The Trump administration simply hasn't made any attempt to fill a welter of incredibly important positions. And as a result, no wonder Jared Kushner has to do everything. There's nobody else there right now.
Yeah.
Nice analysis.
The one point about the poll is it's totally the people who had expressed no opinion from inaugural day on, and bit by bit, everybody who had no opinion is jumping into the disapproved side. The people who approved of Trump on day one are staying with him, but it's the people who, when their pollster called, said, yeah, I'm not really sure, more and more, they're sure.
Yeah, on the Jared Kushner thing, I think this is just another example. I don't think President Trump is all that interested in foreign policy. And I think you can kind of see that both with, his appointments and his and who he picks to be his emissaries.
Either that or real estate developers are really good at it.
Well,
in which case, we could give them a Landino. Do they want a Landino?
Right. Look at the cuts to the State Department in his proposed budget. Yeah. I mean, look, that's he's not that interested in it.
And he entertained the president of Egypt who threw a coup, kicked out a democratically elected president. This guy was persona non grata in the Obama White House, and President Trump greeted him with these words: we agree on so many things. I just want to let everybody know, in case there was any doubt, we are very much behind President el-Sisi. He's done a fantastic job in a very difficult situation. He has imprisoned journalists. He's blamed for the
deaths. That's the kind of thing Trump likes to see.
We agree on so many things.
Yeah, read Peter Baker's piece. It's page one of the New York Times today. It's about the fact that when you have an America First public foreign policy, you tend not to get upset as other presidents would about gassings in Syria or locking up civilians in Egypt and stuff like that. The only question you're asking is, are you good for us? How good for you are us? How good for us are you? And that's not the only question that we expect a president to ask about foreign policy.
So I think, though, too, to be fair, I mean, look, President Obama's Syria policy was pretty terrible. I don't think he was pressed hard enough by the media on that point. So now we're seeing at least the media has woken up and they're pressing on some of these big issues, and I'm glad.
The context, to be fair, the context with Obama was a little different. There was a sense he was engaged and he made some wrong choices. Hillary Clinton disagreed with him. Anybody who wants to revisit the Syrian thing, I would encourage them to get the podcast of Where We Live from earlier this week with the former Syrian ambassador Robert Ford. It was a phenomenal takedown of both Obama then and Trump now.
Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror. Thanks so much, Paz. Thanks to Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Thanks to our own Colin McEnroe. Thanks to Lydia Brown for engineering for us today, and our executive producer, Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.